go out. Yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I haver, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's havering to you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more.
Walking 500 miles.
Yes.
Well, that's a classic from the archives, Deb.
You betcha.
Well played. That's our intro music for our guest. Please join me in welcoming Jeff Ryan, who is author of an upcoming book, The Appalachian Odyssey, and he's quite accomplished as a hiker, and I think you've probably gone more than 500 miles, right?
I have indeed. Closer to 8,000, I believe, at this point.
We couldn't find the song for that, but we will be looking for the 8,000. Well, welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I want to talk about the book that is coming out in print, I believe, in a few months this summer, right, in July?
It is. It's available for pre-order now at Amazon, of course, but it will be out in print in July.
Great. And we'll talk about Appalachian Odyssey and the Appalachian Trail and the content, which I think is fascinating. But why don't we start with your background? You know, just before we went on the air, you were talking about being in this area for 58 years. That in itself, I think, is interesting. So where did you grow up and where did you go to school? And then we'll talk about your interest in hiking and the Appalachian Trail.
Sure. I grew up in Falmouth, probably less than 2 miles from the studio here in Falmouth. And I actually walked in today.
You walked from your home here?
I did. Yes.
Fantastic.
I broke my leg in January and I'm in the recovery phase. So what do? I walk. It's very therapeutic. But I grew up in Falmouth and have lived most of my life here. I took a 4-year hiatus to go to Wisconsin to go to college, but largely because of growing up here in Maine, I think that really spurred my interest in the outdoors. We had woods and fields and such behind my house, so I did a lot of exploring back there, and that really was my first inkling that the outdoors were very important to me, and I spent a lot of time on the water with my parents growing up as well. So we poked around the Maine coast a little bit in their pleasure boat, and it was a really good initiation for me into how much the outdoors played into my life and is so important to me.
Yeah, I read that in your bio. You said a 24-foot powerboat in the Maine coast. My wife and I just bought a boat about a month ago. And we had one prior, but we're really looking forward to kind of extending the reach a little bit.
You know,
Casco Bay and, you know, Maine, I think, has more shoreline than California because of the jagged coast and all the islands. But any tips for somebody who wants to spend the summer exploring this area of Maine by boat or just get out there and visit islands and coast?
I think the thing I learned early on is to develop a sense of positioning with the coast. We very seldom kept the coast out of sight. I think it's a good practice for anyone who's getting their sea legs, as it were, and then just start poking your way up the coast.
Some
Watch
of the
out
rocks
for the low
are scary.
Tide.
I know, but between the lobster pots and between the rocks, sometimes you go out in low tide. And all of a sudden, there'll be rock formations that weren't there. And
you go, and
many times they aren't marked.
A good chart is an essential piece of equipment.
Or a navigator. You may have
there
to go with me out on the boat. So after coming back to Maine, looking at your bio, it looks like you spent almost 2 decades with L.L. Bean.
I did. 19 years, to be exact. And
so what was that experience like as a senior catalog copywriter? I remember in the 80s when you started with Bean, this predates really the internet in the broad sense. I think it existed, but it wasn't very accessible to most people. But I remember in both the 70s and the 80s, the seasonal L.L. Bean catalog being more than just a sales platform. It was a lifestyle, the photography, the writing. It was like when the L.L. Bean catalog came, whether I needed new boots or anything, it conveyed a sense of Maine. So talk about that experience and what, as a senior catalog copywriter, you did over 19 years with L.L. Bean.
It was a fantastic experience. As you mentioned, there was a time, I think it's hard for us to believe now when we get inundated still with mail order catalogs, how special it was to receive the Bean catalog. It was a big event, and it was actually a big event for people to get something from Bean in the mail. It was an exciting thing when the package showed up at your house. And so to be part of that was something I always wanted to do. I remember being 12 years old and thinking that I wanted to write the L.L. Bean catalog, and it took me an awful lot of perseverance to get there and a little bit of happenstance. It's a funny story. I ended up getting a job in the department next to the department that I ultimately wanted to work with, and there were two women writing the catalog there, and they'd bounce ideas back and forth. And I was kind of like the guy who lived on the other side of the fence in the sitcom Tool Time. I was yelling ideas over the wall to these women. I couldn't help myself. I finally started yelling ideas. What do you think of this idea for a headline? And they said, okay, who is this guy? We got to bring him over and introduce him to our boss. So that's how I actually got started writing catalog copy. And it was and is an amazing art form to me. Taking something and deciding how to explain it to people in a very limited amount of space is quite challenging. And it was an amazing experience. You can, because Bean is Bean, the measurement there was quite astounding. And I could see by changing storylines and different angles how people would respond. Largely with the dollars they spent. And so I could see when my stories were resonating with people and when they weren't, and I could adjust accordingly. And as you said, it was a very, very amazing time to be with the company. There was large growth going on, and it was fun to be sort of given at least some of the keys to drive the creative.
So what was the mechanism? By the way, we have Jeff Ryan here. He is author of an upcoming book, The Appalachian Odyssey. It's now available for pre-order on Amazon.com. But when a new product, so the merchandising people came over to your area of L.L. Bean, and there was a new something, a new tent, a new type of coat, apparel, they gave you the product, gave you the specs, and then you had to communicate both the intrinsic element of the product, but also kind of the mythology and the kind of the ethos that personifies L.L. Bean, the sense of outdoors, the sense of authenticity, and, you know, what would Leon do? So what was that like? Was it, you know, it had to be both a creative endeavor, but a lot of pressure because so many people got the L.L. Bean catalog. I don't know what its readership was, but it was huge.
Yeah. There was a little bit of pressure, but I ameliorated that by putting myself in the customer's shoes. And I think it's really important to, when you're writing in print in particular, as opposed to online, I think it's really important to put yourself in the shoes of somebody walking into the store and asking questions. Why is this coat better than that coat, et cetera? So there are certain features that you can draw out, but then again, as you say, there's sort of an ethos and a sort of sandbox in which you're playing that represents the company that you're working for. So you would take the item and you'd put it on and you'd check the zippers out and you'd think, okay, if someone was wearing this jacket in the outdoors, what is this pocket for? What is the advantage of having a two-way zipper versus one that doesn't open at the bottom? What is the collar lined with? Is it lined? That kind of thing. So you really put yourself in the position of someone using the item and call out those features because especially in a medium where they can't try it on, you have to offer that narrative for them.
How often was the Bean family themselves, and this is going back to 1980, so it's about 35 years ago, would they pop in at all? The, you know, leadership or family?
Leon was incredibly involved in the company to a wonderful extent. He was a largely introverted man, but his leadership style was enormous. He didn't have to be the sort of pound your fist on the table type to be an effective leader. I think that was an important lesson to all of us. But he was very clear on the mission of the company that his grandfather started, and when things were in danger of getting off track, and sort of reeled things back in again. And I think having that leadership, that influence, really helped all of us make sure that we were consistent with the way we were portraying things for the in the name of the company.
So after starting at Bean in 1980 as a copywriter, in your bio it shows that you started hiking at a certain point. In 1983, you went on your first long-distance hike, a 6.5-month adventure on the Pacific Crest Trail. Did working at L.L. Bean play a role? Because you're around outdoors, you're writing about hiking boots, and you're writing about the experience. So was that kind of the impetus for your Chautauqua
for
6.5 months going out on the road?
It was. I was like a kid in a candy store. At that time, I wasn't writing yet. I was actually working in the warehouse, and I had gotten a job for a short amount of time working in the camping department in the retail store. But I went back to the warehouse after the Christmas season was over, and I had, in college in Wisconsin, I had met a couple guys that were interested in doing something, some big, hairy, audacious goal when we got out of college at some point. And we talked about doing the Appalachian Trail, actually. And I came home to Maine and I saw a National Geographic that my parents had that featured the Pacific Crest Trail. And I brought it back to college and said, I think I've got something a little bit different. How about walking from Mexico to Canada? And we sort of shelved the idea after everyone graduated and went off to live their lives. But one day I got a phone call from one of the guys, and he said, do you remember that pledge we made back in college? And I said, yeah, what about it? And he said, let's leave Mexico next April 1st. So for the next 8 months, we spent doing logistics and trying to figure out how we were going to do food drops and all that stuff and put the trip together. And Bean was very much involved because I put in a pitch to them to give us products to test for the trip. So they did. They outfitted us with packs and boots. And I think we were among the first people to wear both Gore-Tex and Polar-Tec for an extended period, which were both products that were new to the market.
At the time, that was revolutionary. The whole water repelling, it allowed, you know, breathability in terms of the design and the engineering.
Exactly. And at one point, I had a pack malfunction in Oregon, and it's hard for probably most people to remember the time before fast shipping happened, but I called up L.L. Bean and told the fellow that my pack had failed. And he said, boy, this is a good opportunity to try this brand new thing called Federal Express.
That's
and
funny.
So and 2 days later, I had a pack in front of me in a box in Oregon, and we were astounded at what had just happened because we could continue our trip.
So is that the equivalent of the Appalachian Trail on the West Coast, the
it
Pacific
is.
Crest? And how long is it in comparison to the Appalachian?
The Pacific Crest is 2,800 miles-ish, and the Appalachian Trail is 2,100 miles. And we, as I mentioned, left Mexico on April 1st. And back then, the technology, the new technology notwithstanding, but particularly around food, wasn't very good. And the number of places for you to restock was far, far less than on the AT. Our longest section was 17 days without being able to get any food. So I spent 6 months drying food that I bought at farmers markets or other places and learned how to dehydrate food so we could put boxes together and have my mother serve as mission control and mail these packages out to post offices along the way.
Deb, do you remember all of my stories about the young Steve-O being a Boy Scout?
I love your stories.
Because listening to Jeff, it really brings it back.
It does.
Back in the 70s, yeah, I guess that'd be in the 70s, I went through Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts in a small town just outside of Boston. And it was an incredible experience. And we've had the head scoutmaster for Maine and for both boys and Girl Scouts, mm-hmm. and they do a great job in Maine. It feels like participation has dropped off a little bit as there's more sports and more other activities for kids to do. And it feels like it's also lost a little bit of its coolness in terms of, oh, you're a Boy Scout or you're a Girl Scout. But some of the best friendships and experiences I had involved Boy Scout events and 50-mile hikes. And because we were in Boston, we came up to the White Mountains all the time. And in the winter, we went to Wolfboro, went out on Lake Winnipesaukee, and then went up on Ice Mountain climbing. Mm-hmm. And the outdoors is something I think that is profound relative to the human experience. And here we are in Maine, in New England, where the outdoors is just so incredibly special. So,
yeah. Amen.
And I came just a few fire hydrants short, I think, of painting for either my Life Scout or my Eagle Scout thing. And that's another story of coming close. And
just a couple fire hydrants.
Well, no,
left?
I was active, and then I got involved with sports, and then there was a girl involved.
Oh, and then the girl.
There was a trend there for a couple of decades where I was blaming the girl, but. But yeah, otherwise, you know, it was some of my best experiences were hiking, being outdoors, and doing all that stuff.
That's nice.
So we have Jeff Ryan here. He is author of the book Appalachian Odyssey. His website is jeffryanauthor.com. So from your experience at Bean, and then coming back from your long hike in 83 on the Pacific Crest Trail, you went back to Bean, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went on a hiking kind of challenge of climbing Maine's highest 50 mountains in 1 year. And then in 85, you started just doing a couple of sections of the Appalachian Trail. So is that just a natural progression as you get more personally interested in hiking?
It was. Obviously, the hike from Mexico to Canada was one of my life dream experiences. I've been lucky to have a couple trips of a lifetime, as it were. But it really left a really strong impression on me. How could it not? And, you know, I came back and I gave a slideshow about the show, about the trip.
God, I remember slides.
Yeah.
With one of those carousels?
Yes.
Oh, those were the days. And then when you clicked it,
stuck.
And then there would be a little lever go click, click in the carousel. And now we, you know, I don't think Emily's generation, you don't even know what a slide carousel is, right?
No, I know what it is. I honestly have never used
it's
one, but at least I know what it is.
I know. Yeah. It's like the eight tracks behind you.
Exactly.
You look at those and wonder. But yeah, so you came back with your slideshow.
I gave a slideshow at lunchtime. I was working night shift at the warehouse, and a fellow came up to me afterwards and said, do you ever want to go on a hike? And I said, sure. And we went out and did a couple day hikes or weekend hikes, and we had done a couple of them and said, geez, on consecutive weekends, and we were looking out over the landscape, and I was naming some of the peaks that we could see out in the distance, and I said, this is a crazy idea, but what if we did the highest 50 in Maine in a year? And the next thing we knew, we were off and running.
Do we have – I don't mean this facetiously, but I know some of the major peaks and spent a lot of time up in Cadillac Mountain and Acadia, but, you know, what qualifies as the 50 – largest or highest mountains, and what's number 50? Is it
number 50 is called Deer Mountain, and it's over in the Rangeley area. It's about 3,560 feet, if I remember correctly. So that was about the cutoff,
right?
And then there's the whole question of when you climb Katahdin, do you include all the other peaks around it? No, we just said Katahdin is Katahdin.
Wow. I would have done all the peaks. Every little ridge, every little variation of topography, I would have counted. But no, you were a purist. You went
right.
There
were 17 of them with trails, and the rest of them were all bushwhack with map and compass. So it was a little crazy, and some of it, as you can imagine, in February, out there in the middle of nowhere, going off of snowmobile trails with snowshoes on, et cetera. But it was fun.
So let's talk a little bit about your interest in the Appalachian Trail.
Sure.
And starting in 1985, from our show notes, it looks like you started getting active and doing sections, which for people who hike the Appalachian Trail, I think they'll be familiar with kind of the vernacular. Some people do the whole thing at once.
Mm-hmm. The through hikers.
The through hikers, the big show-offs. and the people with plenty of time on
their
hands.
The ones who like to get it done.
Yeah.
Okay.
And many people do it in sections, and then they kind of aggregate the sections, and whether it's over 1 year or 20 years, they hike, in effect, all 2,181 miles of the Appalachian Trail through 14 states. So what was your, you know, we've had some folks on that work with the Appalachian Trail in the last year, and to me it's fascinating. And, you know, there was some controversy last year that there was a hiker doing a documentary and he filmed up there, and I want to get your thoughts on that. But when you started hiking on the Appalachian Trail, was it just the next challenge, and then did it just last 28 years for you to fulfill it?
Well, it's funny how this all started. We mentioned Katahdin a few times. I love the Katahdin area, and I've been up there many times. And I think at the time I started this whole thing, I'd been up there more than 20 to climb the mountain 20 times. And had just gotten through the highest 50 challenge, as it were, and a friend of mine that I grew up with said he had a college roommate that wanted to go on a hike with me sometime, and he was from Connecticut. So I got in touch with him, and he said he had some friends from Connecticut that wanted to come up and climb Katahdin. So I put the trip together, and we got up there, and we went up the Hunt Trail, which happens to be the Appalachian Trail. And we got to the summit, and we got down, and that was in September of 85. And he went home. We all went home over the winter, and he got in touch with me over the winter and said, hey, I found this other trail in Vermont. It's called the Long Trail. It goes the length of Vermont. Would you ever want to do that? Maybe we could do it in three-day trips, take three-day weekends and go over and do it. So I said, sure, why not? So I bought the guidebook, and we started planning, and we started doing the Long Trail. And the southern half of the Long Trail, the bottom 100 or so miles, is also the AT. So one day we were doing a section down there, and we were in the tent eating dinner, and he said, you do realize we're doing the AT, don't you? And I said, yeah, but I think at this pace it'll take us about 30 years. And he said, so what? So I said, well, I don't have an answer for that. So we just decided that every year we'd do another section, and that led to us finishing in October of 2013.
And did you have the same hiking partner the whole time?
Yes, Wayne Sear is his name. He now lives in New Hampshire, southern New Hampshire, but he was with me every step of the way.
Wow, even that is fascinating. I want to talk about the hiking and the adventure part of it and how many bears you saw and all that. But just the human element of kind of randomly interacting with a guy in 1985 and having that type of friendship that, you know, focused on, you know, primarily a specific activity and doing anything with anyone for 28 years. I don't think I've done anything with I've known Katie for 20 years,
yeah,
and I mean, you know, trajectory looks good. We're going to get to 28
yeah.
years.
No, oh, that's good.
Yeah, but other than that, and other than, you know, my folks,
yeah,
I don't know anyone or anything I've done for 28 years. Have you, Deb?
I don't think so either, but my question is it a friendship or is it just a hiking partner?
Yeah, or is it so
it
focused?
It started as a hiking partnership, and it has turned into a lifelong friendship.
Really?
And that is one of the themes of the book, is that what's really interesting, and you had mentioned earlier that I sort of felt like from the beginning it's like going down a section of whitewater, and you're both in different kayaks. You're experiencing the same thing but in a completely different way.
Right.
And what I saw with Wayne was we were – absolute polar opposites when we started. The only thing we had in common was a love of hiking. And well, there were a few things. We both loved baseball, but he's a Tigers fan. So, you know, so even there was a difference. And he was more even then an extreme introvert and a very numbers-driven guy. And I'm obviously an extrovert and a word-driven guy. And so the way we saw the world was fundamentally different. So it was very interesting how the friendship evolved over the years, because early on, I think I leaned on his skills a lot, and he leaned on mine to a degree. But as I mentioned early in the book, there were times where, in looking back on it now, I kind of treated him like the cruise director, because he was on top of how many miles we were doing every day and where we needed to be off the trail in 2 weeks. And I was just more of a, tell me how far we need to go today, and I'm free to roam. And over the years, that really fundamentally changed. The overlap in the Venn diagram, as I call it, became greater and greater.
I mean, we're going to talk about the book in a minute, The Appalachian Odyssey, but does your friendship and that evolution, does that play a theme in the book, or is it more about the trail itself?
It's a fundamental theme in the book, is how the friendship changed. And it really is sort of a, I don't want to say coming of age, because we were already old when we finished, or at least middle age. But a lot of it has to deal with the differences of how we were seeing and viewing things and our approaches to the trail. And the obvious joy of being out there on the trail was the big center of the target that kept us centered and kept our friendship alive. But the experience that we were building on every year also was the foundation of the friendship. The more you go through things with somebody else and share the experience, the more you have to bring forward. So that's also a large part of it as well.
We have Jeff Ryan here in the studio. You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, and now also on 100.5 FM, and also available on TideSmartRadio.com. Before we talk about the book, which I think is fascinating, why don't we focus on the Appalachian Trail itself, whereas I think that is in itself, beyond, you know, how it's covered or the mythology or the athletic adventure part, it almost has its own identity. It almost has its own mythology when people talk about the Appalachian Trail. And from your book, you have some stats and some information that I have here. And for those listeners who may not be familiar with some of the details, it either starts or ends in Maine or in Georgia. And from having other people on the show before, I don't know if anyone has clarity or if it's defined where's the start or the end, because people obviously go in both directions, right? But there's 14 states. The highest elevation is 6,643 feet. Which is in Tennessee. Lowest elevation is in Bear Mountain, New York, which is almost at sea level, 124 feet. But one of the things that jumped out is you included the AT mileage by state. Maine has 281.4 miles. And I had thought from looking at the map that we would have the most miles. But then you look back to Tennessee, and it looks like Tennessee is credited with 287. It seems like for the extra 6 miles, we could have added a little squiggle and had the lead. It just seems like we lost an opportunity there. And the other thing is the trail kind of straddles the border of North Carolina and Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like if we did some sort of survey, we may find that some of it's in North Carolina.
There you go.
But enough about that. Talk about what is so special. You know, for people who are hikers, they usually refer to it as the AT. People say, oh, yeah, I'm going on the AT, and I did the AT. But talk about, you know, the distance, the challenge, and the whole experience over years going on the Appalachian Trail, how difficult the hiking itself. There are some sections which would be considered light hiking, but there are some kind of treacherous, really hard sections. So let's talk about what the Appalachian Trail is. It was first completed as a continuous footpath in 1937, and then in 1968 it was designated as a National Scenic Trail. But talk about the Appalachian Trail, and then we'll talk about your book and how that kind of captures the spirit of the Appalachian Trail.
Sure. The impetus for the Appalachian Trail was actually the Long Trail, which I mentioned earlier. The Long Trail was the first really long-distance trail in the United States. It goes the length of Vermont, And there was a fellow named Benton Mackay who grew up in, spent parts of his life in D.C. and in New York City, but a large part of his childhood was in Shirley, Massachusetts. And it was a very critical and inspirational part of his life was being outdoors and climbing and exploring those hills when he was a youngster. And he came up with the idea of extending the idea of the long trail to a very lengthy path in the eastern seaboard, primarily because he realized that to him, he felt that wilderness was an essential part of our being and the access to it needed to be available, and it was important. So he envisioned this idea and wrote it up in a land use article that went out in, I think it was 1924. Well, about that time, shortly after that time, a fellow named Myron Avery, who actually grew up in Lubeck, Maine, went to Bowdoin and became a lawyer for the Navy, got involved. And his involvement was really what made the AT come to life. He was the doer. Mackay was the dreamer. And between the two of them, they accomplished an enormous amount in a very short amount of time. I believe that between 1928 and 1937, most of the trail was built, including the shelters, with a lot of Avery's input.
Interesting.
So that's where it came. And Avery was actually the first 2,000-mile hiker. He was such a hands-on person that he believed that he should write the trail guides and be out there and experience the trail. So he was the first 2,000-miler. He also was the impetus for moving the trail. The original idea was to go from Mount Mitchell in Tennessee to Mount Washington. It was Avery who suggested moving, getting another section of trail to go from New Hampshire into Maine and all the way to Katahdin.
Relative to the oversight, my understanding is even though there is an Appalachian Trail Conservancy that kind of oversees the history, because it goes through 14 states, every state, and sometimes within each state, each individual park has their own jurisdiction, their own, you know, kind of sovereignty. And the Appalachian Trail is generally an overlay of other trails that just exist in natural parts. How does that system work, in your opinion, and how has it worked over the last few decades as the trails become more popular?
I think it's worked very well. It's a consortium of different hiking clubs. Like the Potomac Club has a very large presence and did from the beginning, largely because Avery was the president of it when he was living in Washington. I believe he was the first president. But the feeling has always been that these clubs are best able to take care of the trail because they're in proximity to it and have a vested interest. It's an interesting partnership between the individual clubs, the government, if it goes through national or state park entities, and each individual trail group is also responsible for writing and publishing and updating their own guidebook for that particular section of the trail. So that's the proceeds they get from selling the guidebooks
right. Helps
go into the maintenance
of the trail.
So those rules,
whether it's night hiking or whether it's areas that are kind of out of bounds. And that issue came up a little bit last year when there was a documentary relative to the terminus point here in Maine. Talk about that a little bit from your understanding. You weren't involved with that, but obviously as somebody who's very familiar with the Appalachian Trail, our understanding was that the park manager, Bissell, right? Bissell Brothers' dad,
mm-hmm.
who is...
He's the park director.
The park director. So there was somebody who hiked through, got to the end of the trail, and he had a video crew and... I guess they were doing a little bit of celebrating. They wanted to bring some champagne and document it. And then basically the group in Maine said, no, we control this. And what was that about? And how do you think that fits in with kind of the ideology of what the whole Appalachian Trail is supposed to be about and how it works with each section having their own kind of rules?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And as you may or may not know, I think the current stat is over 3 million people do at least part of the AT every year now. That's an extraordinary number. I don't think when Mackay and Avery and others envisioned that amount of use. And there are also different approaches to hiking. The speed hike is obviously diametrically opposite to the way I approached things. I first saw my first speed hiker somewhere in the midst of my own journey, and he was actually from Maine. We came down to a road crossing, and there was a car with Maine license plates, and there was a woman sitting in the driver's seat, and I asked her what she was doing, and she said, "Did you see the guy come running through with a fanny pack a couple minutes ago?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "He's speed hiking." And that was the first time I'd ever heard of speed hiking. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, but, you know, to each their own. He's not bothering anyone. He's not, you know, he's just experiencing the trail in his own way, as long as he's not plowing me over.
So basically just going fast, right? Different
right.
footwear, different it's athleticism, and, you know, there's some athletes. You know, obviously, you can tell from our exchange that I'm into speed running myself, typically to the buffet. And then once I get there, I don't like to push it. I just like to kind of settle in with the banana pudding.
Mm-hmm.
But some people, so is that considered for the purist? Because hiking the Appalachian Trail, for some, it's about the athleticism. For some, it's about the record or the challenge or the achievement. For some, it's about 2,000 miles of nature that's diverse and different and climate. But most of the purists seem like they're in the nature side of it. And as people have get into more extreme sports, that kind of infringes on what some people see as the purity of the Appalachian Trail.
Right. And I can understand that. I guess where I fall with that is I believe that being outside is the most important thing and experiencing it in your own way is fine as long as you're not infringing on the enjoyment that other people are having. In the last several years, I've seen people walking down the trail with earbuds on listening to music, and I think, my own personal opinion of that is I would never do that. You can't hear the birds. You can't hear the streams.
The brooks, the streams.
Of that. You're kind of blocking a whole part of the experience out. But, you know, far be it from me to tell people they couldn't or shouldn't do that. I think that the thing about the speed hiker on Katahdin that bothered a lot of people is that when you get to a place like Katahdin that a lot of people have worked hard to get to the top and they're going for that kind of experience and you have people that are loud or boisterous or whatever, it's taking away from that experience. And I believe that that's why the park officials were upset, that in the spirit of why the park was created, it was created specifically to offer the people a wilderness experience. And it's where that line starts getting blurred that I think a lot of people have
issues. It was created, and also people donated land and deeded land, so with express wishes on how it was used. So
right.
It wasn't just a kind of a public resource that people can self-select. Over the 28 years that you took to complete, what have you seen? Obviously, technology you mentioned is a big thing because in 1980 there were still Walkmans, I guess, with big cassettes, but now everything's smaller and digitized. Footwear has changed. People now have more walking poles. That kind of stuff has changed. But what are some of the other changes you've noticed over three decades walking and hiking along the Appalachian Trail?
I think the use patterns is definitely a big issue. We did not see nearly as many people out 30 years ago as we see now. That being said, we did the majority of our hiking in the fall, and therefore we did not get absorbed largely by the big group
summer
of
vacation.
People that are moving through on doing through hikes. Generally speaking, about 75% of the people start at Springer Mountain, and you have this great number of people that start out, and then there's an attrition.
Yeah.
There's a reality point. We call it the Virginia Blues, which is a common term you hear among through hikers. And as you mentioned, early on you can sort of tick off state mileage in relatively short order, but Virginia is more than a quarter of the trail. It's 500 some odd miles long, and so it goes diagonally across the state, and
right.
It's a long hike across. And I think that's when people start getting the little twangs of, gee, I wonder what a bed feels like. Gee, I wonder what a steak would taste like.
So that's like Heartbreak Hill.
Yeah.
By the way, I just noticed that. I didn't see that on the chart. But it dips in for 4 miles into West Virginia.
It does.
That had to be, I'm sure there's some sort of political story where West Virginia was like, hey, come on, guys.
Yeah.
Just cut in. It's like 4 miles. It barely on the map. It looks like a...
It touches twice.
Touches it barely.
Yeah. Harpers Ferry is one place, too.
For 4 miles and then for 500. We have Jeff Ryan here. We're talking about the Appalachian Trail, which is the subject of his book that will be available in just a couple of months. It's you can look at the pre-order and preview on Amazon.com. It's called The Appalachian Odyssey. His website is jeffryanauthor.com. So, but at what point did you decide that journey you wanted to capture in a book? And I understand you are also involved with photography, so there's many pictures, and so just from the preview, it's a beautiful book. But at what point did you decide, and did you tell your friend Wayne, hey, this is going to be a book, and so now I'm going to have to be taking a few more notes? And then what was that process like, putting pen to paper or digital pen to paper and writing the book, The Appalachian Odyssey?
It was really fun because I had actually been journaling the whole time we were doing it, being a writer. I would take a spiral-bound notebook. I'm kind of superstitious that way. It was actually the same brand. I took all the way through from start to finish, but I would take one and dedicate it to each trip, and every night in the tent, I'd have a journaling session, and so would he, although, as I mentioned earlier, his crib notes are basically that, and I was a little bit longer with my descriptions, but what I accumulated through that was I pretty much knew toward the end of probably with 3 or 4 years to go that this was going to be a book. You mentioned the change in the technology and the photography. It was that part that made it both enjoyable and challenging, because going back to 1985, I was going through some slides, and some of them were quite honestly awful and some of them were pretty good. But the technology had changed so much that by the time we were finishing the trail, I was actually writing on an iPad with a keyboard in the tent at night, which at the beginning, everything was longhand with a spiral notebook. So
you could have had an IBM 370 supercomputer at the beginning, and then all that technology was compressed down to an iPad.
Right. And so, that part of it was really fun. Kind of funny how the book emulates how we actually started the trail, because originally I thought I was going to write 4 e-books, 4 7-year installments. And so I wrote the first one, and it became apparent that this was destined to become an entire book. So I ended up doing that.
Share a couple of your most, and obviously over 28 years and 2,100 miles of hiking the entire Appalachian Trail, there are hundreds and hundreds of experiences, but a couple that may stand out of being either profound or exceptional in terms of drama, or I talked about the mythical bear, and there's lions and tigers and bears all over and snakes. So what were a couple of the highlights that really kind of stood out and that may be included in the book?
Well, maybe not a highlight, but definitely a profound experience was when we were hiking in Vermont, and we came to, we were about 3 miles from where I had parked my truck, and we came upon a day hiking couple coming up the trail, and the woman stopped and she said, "You're not from Maine, are you?" And I said, "Yeah, why?" And she said, "Because there was a porcupine under your truck." And I said, that's interesting. Well, we got down to the parking lot, and to make a long story short, the porcupine had spent the week under my truck eating all the rubber, and we had no brake lines, no gas lines, no radiator hoses. The whole shebang was ravaged.
Didn't really learn that in my nature studies, that porcupines liked eating car parts.
Well, I didn't know that either, and I sure found out with about four weeks worth of paychecks going toward car repair.
What was the name of that movie a couple of years ago with Reese Witherspoon?
Wild. That's about the Pacific Crest Trail.
Right. So in that movie, she went through a bit of a personal crisis,
mm-hmm.
and she sought out to go on a hike to kind of cleanse or purge herself to come out the other side. You must have seen that movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any parallels to seeing that movie other than nature? And, you know, I think at one point she was hallucinating and she went through a lot of different things in terms of substance abuse. So it was really very surreal and existential. Anything existential like that with
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Every hike. I think every hike is cathartic and you are bringing things with you that you need to let go of. And you are opening yourself up to things that you don't know are going to happen to you yet. So there's a constant ability and need to fine-tune to what's going on around you. But at the same time, there's one particular chapter that comes to mind. It's the only time ever that I really struggled mentally, and it was very profound to me. I had basically worked myself into a frenzy with taking on too much work before I left for the trail and then stayed up for 38 hours getting there. And, you know, any rational human being stepping away from that and looking at that from the outside would say you're probably setting yourself up for a bad time. And I just kept trying to power through it using the tools that I always try to power through things with, and they weren't working. And I really found myself berating myself, and it was not a pleasurable experience at all. And I had that happen to me a couple times during that trip. And it was really the only one where I really felt like throwing in the towel. I was tired. I was starting to get a bronchitis. And I just felt like this is the one where we're not going to make it to the other end. And we just kept walking. Wayne convinced me that maybe doing another 3 miles to the next mountaintop would be a good idea. And I said, I'll give it a shot. And I put the pack on. And for some reason, I got this incredible urge and a surge of adrenaline. And it got us to the top. And that's what got us through the trip. Things changed dramatically after that.
Interesting. We have Jeff Ryan here talking about his upcoming book, The Appalachian Odyssey. Talk a little bit about the book tour. I think it's fascinating. It looks like this is from Down East Books, and it'll be available in print in July of 2016. And folks can go to Amazon.com and read about it and pre-order. But shortly thereafter, you're going on a book tour, which in itself is a major undertaking. And a couple things. One, it looks like you're taking your 1985 VW Vanagon with you. And starting in D.C., and I'm guessing you're probably going down the eastern seaboard somewhat close to the Appalachian Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also stopping at 30 L.L. Bean stores. So that's part of your ongoing long-term relationship with L.L. Bean.
It is. I did a lecture up there in last April, I believe, and the turnout was spectacular and the response was even more so. So based on that, they asked me if I might be interested in going to some of their other locations. And the next thing I knew, it was basically all of them, with the exception of Japan.
Wow.
Who knows? But I am going to hop in my Vanagon, and my first stop actually is a book signing at the Smithsonian. I'm going to be doing a signing at the Museum of American History. One of the things we didn't mention is part of the book, several sections of the book deal with history because of the proximity of the Appalachian Trail to Civil War battlefields, some other interesting things that happened, especially in New England, in and around the trail, and some other things. So there's a historical interest in the book, and I'm going to be doing a book signing there, and they're going to be carrying the book in the museum store as well. And from there, I go down the East Coast. I'm going to take a one-week hiatus, park the van in Atlanta, and then fly out to the outdoor retailer show in Salt Lake City, spend a week there doing lectures and book signings at that show, which is the largest outdoor industry show, and then back to Atlanta and then driving up the East Coast.
Fantastic. So what's next? You know, after this, you know, you've done the the West Coast Trail, and so in the Pacific Crest Trail that was kind of featured in the movie Wild from Mexico up to Canada, the Appalachian Trail. Anything east-west?
We've already started.
Really?
Yes.
You and Wayne. Is Wayne still in the program?
Wayne is still in the program, and we've already started a trail that these long-distance trails are sometimes, as you mentioned earlier, cobbled together from some existing trails and then extended. And the newest one that we found is called the New England Trail, and it starts on the shore of Connecticut and basically goes up to Monadnock in New Hampshire. But from Monadnock, we found a connection, which we've already done from Sunapee to, it's called the Sunapee-Monadnock Trail, which gets up into central New Hampshire, and our goal is to go from the Connecticut coast to Canada. So we've already started. We've almost finished Connecticut in a couple trips. We went out last spring and fall and started at the ocean and turned north and started walking.
So. I was thinking of doing the same trail, and I have a Segway, one of those.
Nice.
And apparently they're outlawed on the trail.
Uh-huh.
So that was a little bit of a glitch.
We could do the paved sections.
Yeah. I want to end the discussion on a quote, an early review, which I thought in itself really kind of captures the spirit of your book, but I think it's really interesting. So, I mean, the context for our listeners who have been listening over the last hour to your experience, both as a writer and working at L.L. Bean and being exposed to the outdoors and going on the West Coast, and then your 28-year really pursuit of every step of the way of the Appalachian Trail and then concluding in a book, I think all of it's fascinating. And there's a quote from Robert Poole, former executive editor for National Geographic, and this is his quote. Jeffrey Ryan sets no speed records on the Appalachian Trail, but in a world which sometimes seems obsessed with velocity and superficiality, Ryan's story is a reminder that the long, slow journey taken with friends are the best and the most memorable. His Appalachian Odyssey, destined to be a classic of nature and travel writing, will inspire a new generation of readers to follow in his footsteps. What a great quote.
It's awesome, isn't it? I almost fell out of my chair.
I know. Even if you wrote it yourself, I don't know if you can come up with something. And he captures the juxtaposition of velocity, which, you know, some would say, well, you took 28 years. I think that's a positive because it's like beef stew. You don't want to cook beef stew in 10 minutes. You want it to simmer. You want it to experience all the flavors and all the textures. So this is something that, you know, I wish you the best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
People can find more information, as I said, at your website, right? Jeff Ryan, author, AUTHOR.com. Also, if you go to Amazon and pre-order. I know I'm going to log on and pre-order because I've printed out sections of the preview book, but I think it's something special for people who care about the outside or care about long-time friendship and what that means and long journeys. I think that this is a great read and wish you a lot of luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, been great.
Thanks
having
for
you.
Having me.
You bet. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, and also 100.5 FM, and then also on iTunes for podcasts, and then TideSmartRadio.com. Anything else? What other satellites are we on, Deb?
I think that's it.
That's everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Have a nice weekend.